tonight to welcome to this pulpit Rabbi Daniel Lapham.
Welcome. Thank you. And let me first of all thank all of you. This has really been an absolutely splendid extravaganza. Thank you. You know, it's a great pleasure for me to be here. It's about 4 or 5 years since I was last privileged to be here at a 4th of July celebration. But my relationship with Pastor Joe and with Cedar Park goes back almost to my arrival with my family in the Puget Sound region over 10 years ago. And it's been a close friendship and a friendship that we cherish greatly. I cannot imagine a better way to celebrate the 4th of July. And the reason I say that is because I have no doubt whatsoever that if our founders, those brave men and women, those who signed the Declaration, if they were to come back and be with us this evening, my friends, I know that later tonight, after the skies darken, they would be watching the fireworks. I know that because to them, watching the fireworks and the reason they spoke of celebrating the 4th of July with fireworks was to replicate Moses' raising of the copper snake on the staff in order to cure the plague of snakes that had afflicted the Israelites. For Moses said, one way or another, we have to get the people to lift up their eyes towards the heavens. And that's precisely what fireworks do for us. So I know the founders, if they were here with us this evening, would be at some fireworks display later this evening. The question is, until that moment, until the moment when the rocket's red glare lights up the night sky, would those founders be on the beach with a bottle of beer? Or would they be with us right here in Cedar Park? And I think that if we were to close our eyes and listen to our souls, why, you'll see, they are here. They are with us. Because they knew that the appropriate way to celebrate the 4th of July was to start off paying homage to the Creator, without whom none of this would be here. And while the 6th president of Princeton University, the great John Witherspoon, was making certain that the scholars at Princeton studied the Bible diligently every day. Yes, my friends, an Ivy League university, President John Witherspoon had Bible study every day. While John Witherspoon was doing that, there was a foolish French intellectual called Voltaire. And John Witherspoon was teaching the Bible in New Jersey. And at that exact time, in the 1770s, Voltaire in France was saying that the Bible will be extinct within 100 years. Now let me see, 1770, 1870. My friends, the Bible isn't extinct, but I'll tell you who is. And every now and then, the good Lord sends us beautiful messages that you can just laugh at in sheer joy and exhilaration. Because soon after the death of Voltaire, his house and his printing press was purchased by none other than the Geneva Bible Society. And one of the Bibles that the Geneva Bible Society printed for distribution around the world in the late part of the 18th century recently sold in a British auction house for over $90,000. Before coming here this evening, I checked to find out what would be the price of a complete collected set of Voltaire. You might be happy to hear that the entire works of Voltaire are available for $2. Doesn't this tell you something? And the reason I think that this is important is because I think everybody understands that we, the community of faithful in the United States of America, have an enormous amount to be grateful for to our country. But my friends, I think it valuable to spend a few moments this evening recognizing that we do our share for the preservation and the strengthening of the United States of America. The United States of America thrives, ladies and gentlemen, partially, if not largely, because of your dedication to God's biblical blueprint. How do I say a thing like that? How can we possibly prove that our nation thrives because of your dedication to God's word? What do the two have to do with one another? After all, one belongs to the world of politics and the other belongs to the world of religion. And after all, we know, don't we, that religion and politics have nothing whatsoever to do with one another, right? No, of course not. Because there is one basic principle, and that is politics is nothing other than the practical application of our most deeply held values. If our faiths have nothing whatsoever to say about how families should live, and how children should be educated, and how taxes should be raised and spent, then what sort of faith do we have? It makes no sense whatsoever. And so let's start off by examining a basic principle in how the Creator has created His world. The principle is recognized by scientists as the principle of entropy. However, there is no American family that doesn't recognize this principle as the principle of messy bedrooms. Let me explain. Imagine, if you would, that I were to take a nice big glass jar and I was to lay within it a layer of green marbles. And then right above that, I'd put a layer of red marbles. And above that, a layer of green, a layer of red, green, red, green, red, all the way up to the top. And here we've got a very pretty jar filled with red and green marbles in neat, organized layers. What I'd like to do now is to start shaking this jar before your amazed eyes. Do you notice what's happening? Some of you don't seem to be a bit too sure. Do you notice what's happening? Good. All right. For a moment I thought the public address system had failed. What is happening? Notice the marbles migrating. And now I've been shaking it for only about 30 seconds and look at it. All the marbles are jumbled around. The pattern has gone. Well, no problem. I'll just keep shaking. By the way, how long will it take me to shake all the marbles back into layers? Why do you all laugh? I bet none of you have actually done the experiment. How do you know that that is a ludicrous presumption? Because you've lived with the law of entropy in your daily lives? How about if I be really lavish and allow any sort of pattern? Let's shake till the marbles take a vertical pattern or a diagonal. I'll accept any pattern. Let's keep shaking. How long?
Never.
Probably never, not within our lifetimes. So we throw the bottle away. It's no good to us. But it has proven that there is a natural tendency in the world towards chaos and disorder. It requires enormous injections of energy constantly in order to be able to extract order out of chaos. If we were to take an old vehicle, 100,000 miles on the clock, still drives well, we put it in a field and we watch it for 200 years. At the end of 200 years, what will we find in the field? An operating vehicle? Hardly. There'll be a pile of rusty metal, some broken glass, some decaying rubber. There'd be nothing left. For how long would we need to leave some iron oxide and some glass and some rubber in a field for it to reformulate itself into a Buick? Never. There are ruins in the jungles of South America that were once apparently thriving cities. How long does it take for the jungle to reclaim a city if human beings stop injecting that effort? You know how long it takes? Just a few years, and the city is totally overrun with jungle, the buildings begin collapsing, and pretty soon it is left to archaeologists to uncover, for it is hidden to the eye of most people. How do we explain that? It's easy. You can tidy up your child's bedroom until it is spick and span, spotless and meticulous. How many days does it take before it looks as if a typhoon has passed through? About an hour. Well, how long would you have to wait for your child's natural movement around the room as your child ricochets off the walls on a daily basis? How long before that restores order? I mean, after all, the stuff gets moved around. Surely there has to be one instant at which you can photographically snap everything back in its original position? Never. It doesn't happen. Ladies and gentlemen, it requires enormous injection of energy to keep any order in the world, to maintain a motor car, to keep a house in order, and yes, to keep a society intact and to keep a culture vibrant and vital. Just as it takes considerable energy on a daily basis to maintain friendships, relationships, marriages, families. They don't just stay together. The natural condition is for things to fall apart. And it is only through the injection of energy that we are able to hold everything together. Now, what is the injection of energy that holds our society together? What is the injection of energy that makes it possible for us to all be here in peace and in tranquility and in relative prosperity on a 4th of July, 228 years? After that magical moment in our nation's history? I think I can explain that by telling you of a sermon that was given by one of the great early American pastors, Aviel Abbott, in the year 1799. Now, before I tell you what he said, I want to comment on his name. His name, A-V-I-E-L, Abbott, A-B-B-O-T. Does it ring a bell with anyone? It does with me, because I know Hebrew very well indeed. I don't know a lot of things, but I know Hebrew pretty well. And the name Aviel Abbott is a Hebrew name. Aviel means God is my father. Abbott means fathers. Avot, fathers. And that's a very important name, Aviel Abbott. And so whenever you see anyone called Aviel, and by the way, Hebrew biblical names were common throughout the colonial period and into the early days of America. One of the great pastors of the colonial day, Increase Mather. Anybody know why he was called Increase? Do you know anyone called Increase? Yes, you do. It's just you don't know the translation. That's why you need a rabbi. I just want to make sure that I still have use. And Increase Mather was called Increase Mather by his parents because they wanted to name him after the great biblical hero Joseph. And because they were so familiar with the Hebrew language, and they were, I should tell you that William Bradford, the second governor of the Plymouth Colony and one of our founders, actually wrote his book, The History of the Plymouth Plantation. The first 20 pages in his own handwriting are in Hebrew. I have a Xerox of them. And William Bradford writes in the early pages of his History of the Plymouth Plantation, I have studied the Hebrew language, and I have written part of this book in the Hebrew language because, and I quote him, this is the tongue in which God spoke to the patriarchs of old. It is the language in which God named all the animals of creation. And I have studied that language, the better to understand it, even if only a little, as Moses was only able to see the promised land from far away. A beautiful statement. William Bradford, great scholar of Hebrew, founder of the United States of America. Increase Mather was called Increase because his parents, naming him after Joseph, wanted to translate the very meaning of Joseph. And as anyone familiar with Hebrew knows, the best translation for the name Joseph is Increase. That's what it means. And then Increase Mather had a son called Cotton Mather. Cotton? Do you know anyone called Cotton? Well, you might if you remember that Increase Mather and his wife had a little baby boy who was born a little premature, and he was a tiny, tiny baby. And guess what small or tiny is in Hebrew? Cotton. It's exactly what it is. And so people were deeply aware of the Hebrew heritage. It meant the world to them. And in fact, there are more places in the United States of America with Hebrew place names than there are in the Holy Land, in Israel itself. There are 24 Hebrons in the United States of America. I lost count of how many Salems there are. Salem is the old biblical name for Jerusalem from the book of Genesis. Melchizedek was the king of Jerusalem in the early days. And even down the road, if you drive down I-5 to the city of Portland, shortly before you reach the Columbia River, you pass through a small, small town called PL. And if you look at the history of PL, you'll see that the founders called it PL, the mouth of God. And so Aviel Abbott, in 1799, gave a 4th of July sermon in which he said, it is clear that there is no nation on earth that bears a closer parallel to ancient Israel than the United States of America. And that gives us a hint as to what the energy is that is constantly injected into American culture in order to preserve what we have here. Let me go to some specific examples. My friends, you only have to spend a vacation out of the United States of America in another country, and out of a spirit of politeness, I shall refrain from mentioning any particular country. But there are several countries around the world in which you can spend a vacation, and it's downright unpleasant because the people there have no manners. Now, where do you think manners come from? Do you like living in a place where people have manners? I do. It means a lot to me. So much so that we and you, I'm sure, go to great lengths to inculcate these manners in our children. But where does the whole idea of manners come from? What are some of the things that we think of as manners? Well, eat politely at the table. Raise the food to your mouth with implements, not with your fingers, and certainly don't lower your mouth to the plate and slurp the soup up out of the bowl. If you do that, your mother, if she went to the same mothering academy as my mother, might well say to you, stop eating like an
animal.
Exactly, that's right. That gives us a clue as to where these manners came from and why it is that other countries that are not as firmly rooted in a Judeo-Christian biblical tradition do not have these manners. Great Britain, until the period of roughly the First World War, was deeply committed to biblical values. In a way, it was similar to America today. The entire purpose of the British Empire, if you look at the contemporary writings of the day, the British spread over the world not for monetary gain, because computerized analyses of the books of the East India companies and the various expeditions show that by and large the colonies did not bring money to England, they consumed money from England. So why did England do it? If you look at the writings, they did it to spread the gospel. Africa was first brought into contact with modern civilization by missionaries sent by Queen Victoria. That's what happened. They were devoted. One of them was immortalized by Catherine Hepburn in African Queen. When Humphrey Bogart had drunk several bottles of gin too many, and Catherine Hepburn, playing a missionary, said to Bogart, what do you do this for? You are demeaning yourself. You're making yourself into nothing. And he said, oh, leave me alone. It's just my nature. And she stood up and looked down at him as imperiously as only Catherine Hepburn was capable of doing. And she said, it's your nature, Mr. Allnut. I have to remind you that nature is precisely what we were put in this world to rise above. To eat like an animal and to say, well, it's just natural, I'm an animal, you're missing a fundamental point. And if you strip Judeo-Christian faith out of America, you will strip away manners. Because all of this stems from the basic story that you all know, which is that the apes and the angels were in a tug of war for the soul of Adam and Eve. The world of nature, represented by the serpent, and Adam and Eve, knowing full well what God wanted them to do, or in this case, not to do. Animals eat whatever tastes good, or whatever looks good, or whatever they feel like eating, but human beings are capable of exercising restraint. And there was this tug of war, and Adam and Eve yielded. And that brought death into the world. And that brought the idea of redemption into the world. And the ability to make up for what Adam and Eve did and to forever turn our backs on behaving like animals. The great poet John Milton wrote a marvelous poem called Paradise Lost, in which he describes exactly what I've been telling you. And so from that day to this, those of us faithful to God's biblical blueprint know that there is enormous value in not behaving like animals. And that's why in America, unlike many other countries of the world, when you step into an elevator, for the most part, you will not be surrounded by people who stink. You will not be surrounded by people who scratch themselves in public. You will not be surrounded by people whose bodies emit loud and vulgar noises. I'm sorry, but you have to know there's a difference. And the difference comes because America was based on God's biblical blueprint. And you, by your devotion to that blueprint, are injecting the energy that preserves the United States of America. We have manners in our public life because you and millions of other faithful Christians and Orthodox Jews are devoted to keeping alive the biblical blueprint of God Himself, the Bible. That's why it is pleasant to live in America. But it is also economically viable to live in America. We enjoy a life, each and every one of us, of such prosperity that over 90% of the inhabitants of this planet would change places with the poorest of us in a heartbeat. Is that an accident? Do you suppose it's just a coincidence that the most Christian nation on earth is also history's greatest engine of prosperity and economic vitality? Just a coincidence? Is it a coincidence that every country rooted in atheism is a country whose residents have to stand in line to buy a tomato? It's not a coincidence at all, because we understand something directly from God's biblical blueprint, and we keep it alive and inject it as energy into the culture. Because, my friends, nobody, but nobody truly excels at anything that deep down he considers to be morally reprehensible. And it is through the Bible that we get a sense that prosperity and having a degree of financial comfort is not a mark of sin at all. It's something else entirely. We see, for instance, that we have a very cheerful and wonderful, loving God during the early days of creation. Whatever God sees, He likes. He is a very cheerful God. Whatever He makes, He looks at it and says, that's good. How many times does it say, and God looked at it, yep, that's good? 8 times. The 8th one is about gold. Gold? Yeah, gold is good. And that is why it is gold, not platinum and not any other metal, that is ultimately the metal that is used for monetary value throughout the history of the world. Because in the book of Genesis, God says, yep, that gold is good. But that's not the end of the story. Very soon after that, we meet for the very first time a grumpy God. God gets upset. What is the very first time in which we find God saying, not good at all? When He looks at Adam and He says, not good for man to be alone. And so we see that there is a relationship between man being alone and the gold that is good. The gold is good, but it isn't good for man to be alone. What is the relationship between those two things? Well, it's very simple, you see. How wealthy is the last human being on earth? If you imagine some horrible thing that takes away everybody except one last man, do you think he's wealthy? I mean, after all, he owns all the money, he owns every building, all the real estate, he owns all the vehicles. Surely he's the wealthiest human being that ever existed. How does he live? Well, for the first few moments he's happy. He says, I'm going to be able to get a parking space at Cedar Park. But then he goes home and says, well, I've been looking forward to a night with television where I can keep the remote. And he tries to click it on, but there's nobody operating the electrical utilities, and there's nobody running the TV station. No problem, he says, I'll just read a book. And he reads until the sun goes down, but there's no electricity after that. And pretty soon we discover that the richest man on earth is living the life of desperate survival. He's living the life of a subsistence farmer in a third world country, because after the food in the local supermarket runs out, he has to plant food and hope that a harvest comes in before he starves to death. That's the richest man on earth. And you see, we have a very clear picture in the story of Cain, because Cain thought that the way to wealth was to get rid of all the competition. And the Bible tells us that Cain went to Abel in the field and he said to him, and you frantically flip the page to the next verse to find out, what did Cain say to Abel? And there's nothing there. And that's because there is an ancient Jewish principle that no unnecessary words ever appear anywhere in the Old Testament. And if the Bible does not tell us what Cain said to Abel, it must be because we can figure it for ourselves. And it's pretty obvious. Father Adam is getting on in years, right? He must be already, probably 800 years old. And Cain says to Abel, what do you think? He says to him, Abel, Dad's getting old, and I just want to work out with you that when death eventually takes him back to his father in heaven, you and I, we're going to have to deal with the world. It belongs to us. And I want to just explain to you, as the oldest son, I'll be taking the world. But you're welcome to be a tenant and just pay me rent. What do you think Abel responded? Abel responded and said, Cain, I don't think you understand. What's happening is that after father goes home, we will be splitting the world half and half. And what's more, I'm taking North America. All right, that part I just put in. And so what does Cain do? Now here you need me again, because you need to know that the word Cain in Hebrew means acquisitiveness, acquire, a desperate need for material acquisition. And so if your name is Cain, and your brother has just said that he is going to take away half of the whole world from you, what do? You kill him, of course. That's being true to who you are. You have to do that. And God punishes Cain with two punishments. Now, most people are familiar with the one where he has to be a wanderer and never can be stationary in any spot, but there's a second one. God also says, anything you plant will never grow. You know why? Because God is teaching Cain a big lesson, and that is that your wealth depends upon other people. That's what it depends on. And so Cain, you thought you would own all the land by killing Abel. Okay, you're welcome to it. You may have all the land. Now what can you use land for? Only two things. Development, you can build buildings, or you can grow things. That's what you do with land. And God says to him, so Cain, enjoy the land, it's yours. However, you're always going to have to keep moving, so you'll never be in one place long enough to put a building up, never be in one place long enough to get tenants, never be in one place long enough to get rent, never be in one place long enough to even live in one of your buildings, so we've taken care of that. And as far as the other side of it, agriculture, sorry, nothing you plant will ever grow. So now we'll see if your idea of getting wealthy works. That's the message. And Cain does repentance. You know what he does? The very next thing it says, Cain has a child. It doesn't tell us anything about the wedding ceremony. It doesn't tell us who catered. It doesn't tell us who he picked as a wife, which in itself, if you think about it, is a problem. It doesn't tell us anything of this. All it tells us is that Cain had a child. Why? Because he's telling God, I've learned my lesson. I thought that the way to wealth is to get rid of other people. I've now learned that the way to wealth is to have other people around. So here's a child. I'm going to make up for the one I killed. And what's more, I'm going to call him Hanoch. But in Hebrew, education. I have been educated, God. I've learned my lesson, hence the name of my son. What's more, I'm going to build the first city in history. I know there's just a few of us, but we're going to build a city anyway. It's going to be the first city in history dedicated to you, and it's going to be dedicated to the idea that people need one another. We need to be together in a group and in a crowd. And that is why, from that day to this, wealth is created in cities, not in small and tiny hamlets across the countryside. Wealth is created in the cities of the world because of Cain's understanding of what happened. And so we recognize this, and we realize that the gold comes about only because it's not good for man to be alone. And we find the story clarified later on with the story of Joseph, where Joseph does the strange thing with his brothers. Do you remember? He sends the brothers back, and they open their bags, and the money they paid is in the bag, and they're frightened, and they come home, and they don't know what to say, and they don't know, and their father Jacob catches on. The message Joseph is sending them is crucial. Remember back what happened originally between the brothers and Joseph? What did they say when they hauled him out of the pit in which he was destined to die a horrible and lingering death? What did they say when they took him out of that pit? They said, "What profit is there in killing our brother? We don't want to do that. What profit is there?" In other words, the brothers had not fully understood the lesson of Cain yet. To the brothers, it was all right to jeopardize relationships to make money. And Joseph is saying to them, "You're missing the point. It's not about the money. I'm sending the money back to you. The money comes as a result of the closeness and the relationships. It's not something you sacrifice the relationships for. That's the secret of wealth. God wants us to be wealthy? No, I wouldn't say that. I don't think that's true. But I do think that God wants us to be absolutely obsessed with taking care of one another's needs and obsessed with helping one another and doing things for one another. Don't be surprised if He rewards us for that kind of obsession with the kind of fiscal vitality that America has been fortunate to enjoy for these last few hundred years. It is all directly from the Bible. It is not a coincidence that countries that have had no contact with the Bible flock to America for financial success. They turn to America, they emulate America, they desperately strive to import American ideas. And the one basic idea they haven't caught on to yet is that their system will run down through the process of entropy. It'll fail if there is no constant injection of energy in the form of God's biblical blueprint. And my friends, finally, even military defense, even the idea that it is virtuous to defend ourselves, it is virtuous and proper to pay honor to those men and women who face death in order to defend America, to make American blood expensive. Because, my friends, what had happened over the last few decades of secularism's advance into American culture was little by little, in the eyes of the nations of the world, American blood became cheap. And it is in the book of Exodus that God Himself is called a man of war. And it is in the book of Ecclesiastes that the great King Solomon develops this lesson and says there is a time for peace and there's a time for war and there is a time for killing if that is the only way to protect ourselves. That is right, and it must be done. As painful as the duty is, it must be done. And countries that lose their Christian heritage, like England did after the period of the First World War, lose their will to defend themselves. And that is why England sat by idly while Hitler rearmed himself and nearly thrust the world into another 100 years of darkness. It came terribly close. And once again, it was the United States of America that came to the rescue of the old world and saved civilization, just as it is America and only America that is once again coming to the defense of civilization now and saving the world from yet another 100 years of darkness that is threatened. My friends, the culture exists the way a family exists only by the injection of vast amounts of energy. And it's by your commitment and your dedication to God's biblical blueprint. It is your dedication to injecting that energy into the culture and making certain that these ideas echo throughout America. It is because of that that we have a civil society of mannered people. And it's because of that that we have an economy that works. And it's because of that that we have a military capable of defending ourselves, all dependent upon the constant injection of energy that is provided by people just like yourself in wonderful churches, just like Cedar Park. I tell you, in conclusion, that one of the signers of the Declaration, Dr. Benjamin Rush, watched a 4th of July parade in the city of Philadelphia in the year 1788. And just as I am, every single 4th of July, when we sing the Star Spangled Banner and when we say the Pledge of Allegiance and the flag is raised and the color guard comes in and the tears fill my eyes, Benjamin Rush was profoundly moved as he watched a celebration in the streets of Philadelphia in 1788. And Benjamin Rush wrote these words, my friends. He said, "And to me, the most pleasing and uplifting spectacle was two ministers of the gospel walking arm in arm with the rabbi of the Jews, celebrating our great nation." Let me, in a small attempt to replay that magical moment from 1788, let me ask my dear friend Pastor Joe Featon to come up and let's stand arm in arm for a moment to replay what Benjamin Rush saw on the 4th of July, 1788, a minister of the gospel and a rabbi of the Jews.
Amen. Good. 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 Good.